kill and steal everything which is forbidden in Judaism. We need to be very clear, and we need to understand a very simple concept. There is a great difference between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism is a religion, an ancient, old, thousands of year religion, and masses of Jewish people, basically the entire Jewish people that followed this religion for thousands of years. Then we have a relatively new movement, a national movement which has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with godliness, a purely political movement, basically transforming Judaism from a religion into a nationalism. Should never be confused. In addition, my final point is that we have to understand, and masses of people in the world need to understand, that the state of Israel as a government, as a movement, in no way represents world Jewry. It's a group of people who happen to be from Jewish descent, who don't follow anything of Judaism, and still in all, they do everything they can, and all crimes they commit, all violations of God's word and God's Torah, and unfortunately, they still insist to represent all Jews. This is not the case, and should never be. They should never be considered as the representation of myself, my family, my communities, or the Jewish world at large.
The new data coming out of Israel on the tensions between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community gives clues of a crumbling society. The data shows that it is merely impossible for secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community to coexist side by side. They believe that they are too different to live in the same neighborhood. The Israeli project meant to bring the two groups together to justify it as a home for all Jews. But it seems that not all Jews feel this way, as there are some fundamental issues that Israel can't seem to get rid of. For now, it seems that the crumbling apart of Israeli society continues, all the while politicians have immersed themselves in a fourth election after three failed ones in less than 2 years. Here are the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. A large majority of the Israeli public, 56%, believes that an incident similar to the storming of Capitol Hill by masses of protesters in Washington could take place in Israel. A poll conducted by Menachem Laser from Panels Politics for Ma'ariv, the Jerusalem Post's sister publication, found that 23% of respondents are sure that such an incident could take place in Israel as well. And another 33% guessed that such an incident that shook the U.S. 2 days ago could happen as well. YNED News. Riots erupted on the streets of two predominantly ultra-Orthodox communities after police broke up two massive illegal weddings just hours after Israel announced it was tightening its coronavirus lockdown. Police officers who arrived at the scene following reports of a mass event at first couldn't enter the event hall, which had a lock on the doors. Upon entering, the Rebbe was asked to disperse the event, but in response he offered police officers wine, who allowed the mass event to continue, with hundreds of attendees dancing and singing in a confined space with no social distancing or face masks. The Times of Israel. The Israeli Shin Bet Internal Spy Service hacked the phones of several anti-Netanyahu protesters on suspicion they sought to break into the Prime Minister's residence in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, Channel 13 News reported. The report said the agency was granted authorization to read messages on demonstrators' phones and search their homes after a number of protesters breached a police barricade outside the compound, with Netanyahu and his wife Sarah reportedly moved to a safe room. I-24 News. As Vice President Biden condemned building of 1,600 housing units in occupied eastern Jerusalem Al-Quds in 2010, Israel is expected to greenlight construction of new housing units in the eastern part of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds before the swearing-in of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden on January 20. Public broadcaster CAN reported.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام من شقاء العيش ضيق المنزل
إمام الباقر عليه السلام stated a misfortunate way of life entails living in a cramped house.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the historical textbooks a very interesting and profound conversation between a student and a teacher, a disciple and a master. In this beautiful tradition, which in reality is a conversation between a very knowledgeable student by the name of Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this conversation we find very profound statements are put forth. Now, as we have said in prior segments, the conversation itself is quite long, so we have decided to pick out bits and pieces of this conversation between this student and the master, which are applicable to our lives. Now, of course, as we have said, this conversation is full of commandments which inculcate moral standards and beautiful ideals in human beings, to the extent that if one were to apply all of these standards which have been stated in this conversation, then it could very well lead one towards perfection. So one of the things that Imam al-Baqir said in this conversation with Jabir bin Yazid was that there is no disaster like your disdaining the sin and your satisfaction with the conditions in which you are. And so here we find that Imam al-Baqir is telling us that considering a sin to be small or overlooking a sin because we believe it is small, or perhaps not worrying about the sins which we commit is in actuality a great disaster. And also, he says to Jabir bin Yazid that to be satisfied, complacent, easy and comfortable with the condition that you are in is also a disaster. And why? Because we find that when we are complacent in the conditions in which we are, if it's okay, it's not a big deal, then there is no room for us to make progress. And if you are not making progress, then you are stagnant. And just like water goes bad when it is stagnant, so do the lives of people. And so we must always remember to continuously be in the mode of making progress, whether little or much. Beautiful words exchanged between student and teacher, between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this very historical and profound dialogue.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Imama of Imam al-Baqir was for 19 years. And especially from the time 95 to 114 when he passed away, this time was the time of spreading the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And the main factors, or one factor specifically, which made Imam al-Baqir to be able to spread the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt to Muslims in generally and in Shias in particular, it was the time of shift of power from Bani Umayyah to Bani Abbas. They were busy fighting against one another. Imam got the opportunity and he started spreading knowledge. And this, according to historians, the period was known as Ahadul Infiraj, grace period, when Imam alayhi salam decided to teach specifically the Shia and generally all Muslims, including Abu Hanifa and many other figures, came to learn from him.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of the life. Keys of life.
Aqil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. We're talking about how we are able to deal with ourselves and the importance of making sure that we take care of our body, our spirit, our soul. And of course, just reminding you that we're on part one of the book, which is how to deal with yourself. And of course, then we go on to, inshallah, later on into part two, how you deal with others, how to deal with others. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Man katama al-atiba maradahu khana badana." Someone who conceals their sickness from doctors, they are indeed betraying their body. You know how I said that we have a responsibility, we have an obligation. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has entrusted this body to us as an amana, so we can't do with it as we wish. Absolutely not. We can't inflict any kind of harm onto it. We can't do something that we have no right to do, because it is an amana in our hand, our body, and also our soul. So the amana, we have to treat it in the best way possible. One of the ways of us preserving that amana and protecting that amana is by making sure that not only do we keep it away from illnesses, from sicknesses, but also we keep it towards the best means and the best possible treatment as much as we are able to. Of course, when we're talking here about concealing, I just like to make point here. Later on, we're also going to be talking about how a person needs to make sure that they don't nag and complain about each and every sickness that they have. And concealing their sickness is also a good thing. But concealing it from who? You know, here we're talking about if you have a sickness, you need to make sure that you seek consultation and guidance from a professional, that you don't, you know, say, well, I'm going to bear with the sickness, I'm not going to talk to a specialist about any of this. That's the wrong kind of approach. I'd also like to share another hadith that Sheikh Jawadi also mentions here, from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. That's also a kind of lesson for us. We go through different seasons throughout the year, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that one way of us, you know, bringing about correct approach in our planning for the year as far as avoiding sickness and staying healthy. He says, توقعوا البرد في أوله وتلقوه في آخره. توقعوا البرد, which means that you should welcome, that you should protect yourself from the bird in the beginning. So when autumn comes, make sure that you dress as much as possible, that you keep yourself warm in the beginning of the cold season. وَتَلَقَّوْهُ فِي آخِرِهِ, and at the end of the cold season, entering into spring, for example, you should welcome it, that you should receive it. So don't wear that much warm clothing, for example. تَوَقَّوُ الْبَرْدِ فِي أَوَّلِهِ وَتَلَقَّوْهُ فِي آخِرِهِ فَإِنَّهُ يَفْعَلُ فِي الْأَبْدَانِ كَفِعْلِهِ فِي الْأَشْجَارِ. Because cold weather does to the body the same as it does to trees.
آیت الله جوادی آمولیدی, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرون دماز و سواب داره فرون روزوان است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم سواب داره, دعا هم داره, سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته بودم گفته دی. اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری سواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری سواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
أوله يحرق وآخره يورق. It starts off, so coldness does to a tree, coldness, cold weather burns the tree, right? And that's why in autumn, you know, the tree, the leaves of tree fall. أوله يحرق وآخره يورق. And at the end of the season, when spring starts, leaves start to grow again. So that's exactly what's happening to a person's body. Into a person's body, when you are protecting yourself from the beginning of winter, you are protecting your body from it being affected by the cold weather. And then towards the end of the cold season, you are now receiving it and welcoming it by not wearing that much clothes. And of course, that's going to bring about, you know, a kind of positive sustainability, which is a good thing. وَآخِرُهُ يُورِقْ. يُورِقْ coming from the word وَرَقْ, وَرَقُ الشَّجَرُ, which means leaves. Now, talking about all of these things and speaking about how we are able to keep ourselves healthy and prevent from sicknesses. Again, here there's a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that speaks about تقليم الأظافر وأخذ الشارب, that you cut your nails and you shorten your moustache, من جمعة إلى جمعة, from one Friday to another Friday. Later on, we're going to have a special episode on, you know, what's recommended to do on Fridays. أمان من الجذام, that it is a safety from leprosy. Again, here we're talking about something as simple as cutting nails and it having an effect of keeping you secure and safe from certain sicknesses like leprosy. Or ترك العشاء مهرمة, that if you don't have dinner, it's going to lead you to become feeble and weak and of old age. وينبغي للرجل إذا سنى أن لا يبيت إلا وجوفه ممتلئ من الطعام, that an old person, when they reach a certain age of elderness, they should always try to make sure that their stomach is full of foods. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
E-Waste Tragedy, Part 1.
This is one of the most notorious dump sites for e-waste in the world. We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like this dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago to see youngsters who work in the toxic smoke while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water and air. E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. And when I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers. The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved. Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it. who used it. These are high-profile public places. Universities, hospitals, the banks. The first one that I found was like 8 years ago. They're very bulky for my luggage, so I'll need to cut them so it'll fit in.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Annan. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste that have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa, or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana. Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can with that particular piece of waste from the serial numbers they can date it. But I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I said, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana. All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago. After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses has been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed which, in a nutshell, works like this. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belén and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Belén is taking a computer to a municipal collection point. The tracker inside is already live, and Belén is recording the journey of the computer right up to the entrance. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for 2 euros. A fridge will yield up to 10 euros, and a system unit 4 euros. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, 10 million euros. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belén's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belén's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste, tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. He is hiding his face to avoid perjudicating future cases. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled, but D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering three continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and €2 a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo in Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continued to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends €130 billion a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. €50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about €40,000. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anane has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are work in order, but sort of material sitting behind that's not work in order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. But what about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler? They'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
In the person of Bibi Fatima, we see the example, the best example of a lady who maintained her modesty as explained by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, and by her own father, the Prophet, in his sunnah, sayings and examples. Being modest in dress and behavior does not mean that a woman cannot contribute positively in the society. There is a wrong understanding that hijab is a barrier in seeking knowledge or in being, you know, positively contributing to the society. Some of the racist elements, especially in the Western part of the world, actually use the hijab as an issue of attacking the minorities by saying that, you know, this is a sign of suppression, you know, and this is not something which is there only in the books of the events of the past. Even now, you know, you have a recently appointed Minister of State of Women in the province of Quebec by the name of Isabella Charest. And she actually makes it very clear when she was asked about it that Muslim hijab is a symbol of oppression. And it's not something that women should be wearing. She goes on to say that when they are dictated by religion, is what they should wear, or what, when they are dictated by religion and what they have to wear, for me, it's a lack of liberty. Well, that's your opinion. And if you're really true to your opinion, that you should not single out Muslim women only. You should also include the Catholic nuns in that category. Because even they, according to their own religious, you know, instructions and requirements, they have to use what is known as habit, which is very similar to the hijab. But you know, it's only Muslim women who are basically singled out, and to say, oh, they are oppressed and we have to liberate them from the zulm that they are going through. Well, when you talk about liberty, liberty means that even those who want to wear the hijab, let them wear the hijab. You know, and this is where we see that the issue of racism comes in. You know, for us, the example is Fatima Zahra. When the Prophet described her as Fatima tubada'atu minni, that Fatima is part of me, this is not just an emotional statement being made by the father regarding his daughter. You know, all the fathers would say, yes, she is my daughter is part of me. But this is where we have to realize that when he says, whoever hurts her has hurt me. Whoever has pleased her has pleased me. These kinds of very general statement, without any condition, shows that it's not just the father talking about a daughter. This is Rasul of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talking about a waliyatullah. And that is how you have to look at this example. That Fatima al-Zahra basically was in a way she was an assistant, you know, in the role of providing education, especially for the women those days. We don't hear much examples about it. But one example I would like to, you know, mention it again here is a narration of a lady who came to see her one day, and she says to Bibi Fatima, "Inna li walidatun za'ifa. I have an old mother at home. وَقَدْ لُبِسَ عَلَيْهَا فِي أَمْرِ صَلَاتِهَا شَيْءٍ." Certain things about namaz, you know, she is confused about it, about the salat, and she wants some clarity. And so she has sent me to you to ask those questions. So she asked one question after another, but after a while she stopped. ثُمَّ خَجِلَتْ مِنَ الْكَثْرَةِ. She became kind of embarrassed, you know, to ask more and more and more. And this is where she says, "Ya bint Rasulullah, I don't want to bother you anymore. Trouble you more." And this is where the response of Bibi comes. She says, "Hati Sali, you know, come. Ask me amma bada alak. Ask me whatever is coming to your mind or what you have in your mind. Araiti man alladhi yas'adu yawman ila sathin yahbi hamlin saqilin wa kira'uhu 100,000 dinar ayasqulu alayhi." You know, she says, just think about somebody who has been hired one day to carry a heavy burden, you know, from the ground to the roof of the house. And he has been told that if you do this, you will be paid, you know, 1,000 dinar. Will that fellow consider that weight to be heavy? No, because of the, you know, reward, he will gladly do his work. And she says, no. You know, he wouldn't feel that to be a burden. And this is where she says that I have been hired. Now, who has hired her? She says, I have been hired for every mas'ala and question that you ask me. I will be rewarded by the arjul sawab, which in value would be more than the pearls fell from the sky to the earth. And so for me, there is no burden here, no difficulty. Ask whatever you want to ask. And then she goes on and extends that hadith, talking about, you know, those who will be the guardian or the orphans of Ahlul Bayt, in the sense of the ulama who will maintain the aqidah of the community during the absence of the imams themselves. And so this is where we come to realize that, you know, Fatima al-Zahra, yes, she was a symbol of modesty and hijab, but that did not prevent her as far as seeking knowledge, sharing knowledge with the community is concerned. And when the time demanded, she was the most vocal and strong supporter of the wilayat of Ali bin Abi Talib. You know, Amir al-Mu'minin actually said something when he buried her. After the burial, he says, there were two supporting pillars for me. One fall down with the wafat of Rasulullah, and the other one fall down today. So for him, you know, the presence of Fatima al-Zahra was not just as a wife, but somebody who was very strong in supporting the cause of Amir al-Mu'minin. And that's where even she goes to the gathering, of course, with the hijab and with the curtain, anything, maintaining everything as far as modesty is concerned, you know, to talk about her own right and the right of her husband, Ali bin Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wassalam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali Mulhali Hakim Mati. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.